This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Hunt of a lifetime, changing lives one adventure at a time, empowering kids with courage. Join us in creating memories for kids facing life-threatening illnesses. We are here to make dreams come true, from magical outdoor escapades to heartwarming experiences. Every moment is cherished. With every step of our young heroes, find a network of support, love, families, volunteers, and friends unite to uplift spirits and spread smiles. Amidst breathtaking landscapes, kids find strength they never knew they had. Together, we conquer challenges and celebrate victories. Be a part of the movement that transforms lives. Your contribution can bring courage and hope where it's needed most. Go to huntofalifetime.org to get involved. Let's create a world of cherished moments and unstoppable bravery. Brought to you in part by Maine Operation Game Thief, New Hampshire Wildlife Heritage Foundation, International Wildlife Crime Stoppers, and the North American Game Warden Museum. Please join me, Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and other Game Wardens on our adventures protecting wildlife, saving lives, and having fun, all while serving the public and the natural resources of our planet. Listen to the tales and experiences of those who work in the outdoors while being entertained with stories about encounters with poachers, wildlife investigation, murder investigation, near-death experiences, search and rescue missions, wildlife interactions from game wardens around the country and around the world. When I retired, I realized I couldn't let go of that legacy, but rather wanted to share the passion, the commitment, and the stories of those men and women that call themselves game wardens. This is Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and this is Warden's Watch. Warden's Watch, episode 117. Undercover Maine Game Warden Bill Livesley. I sit down with Bill and we talk about his life experiences as a young man, how he pulled himself up from horrible situations, his experience with law enforcement as a young child when his father was killed in a confrontation with law enforcement, and how he became a Maine game warden and then excelled at undercover work. Very great sit-down podcast, because Bill puts this all down on paper for you to read in his book, Let's Go for a Ride. And what an epic story of a Maine game warden it is. So I would encourage you to grab Bill's book and sit down, because you can't put it down once you start reading it. The true story of Bill's life and career. Enjoy this podcast. As always, I did. And don't forget to give us a rating. And if you're into like watching these interviews, most of these interviews are videotaped and are on Patreon. So for $5 a month, you can actually go to Patreon
and watch a lot of these videos. We have a lot of extras on Patreon too, with different pictures and things we try to put on there. So certainly a way to support the podcast and get a little extra out of it. So welcome to this episode of Warden's Watch, where we're sitting down with Bill Livesey, former Maine game warden, undercover, and author now of Let's Go for a Ride.
Yes, but sir.
I just, you know, and we just started this whole conversation because I love that title, and titles have power as far as I'm concerned. And
oh, yeah.
Yeah. And when you said that, I'm like, yeah, that's how probably everything starts.
That's how every undercover case shifts into that mode when the bad guy says, let's go for a ride.
Because that vehicle is their catalyst to wherever they're going and doing it.
Right.
So, unless they're doing it right out the back door.
And that happens too.
Yeah. And then it's, let's go for a walk. That'll be the sequel, right?
Right. But it's always words to that effect, whether you're riding or it's go time. It's another way to say it.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
So, you know, you got quite the background story, Bill, you know, growing up, starting off, an experience as a child that's probably pretty sucky, you know?
Yeah, there was some, those very dysfunctional events, unfortunately, yes. Mm,
but I think it got built for you to do this job.
I'm pretty convinced now, looking back on it. I didn't know I was being given some very important gift sets, skill sets, until looking back on how things, that's how life is anyway. You look back and you're like, wow, that really is the cause of what formed this, you know, and I can look back and see all that now.
Yeah. Do you mind sharing a little bit of that?
Sure. I'm open about it all the time. People ask me some details, and that's why some people actually encouraged me to write a book and express some of those things, because it was, my dad was a really good guy at one point in his life, hard work and very driven, kind of like game wardens driven to catch poachers. My dad was driven to make money. That's kind of that unfortunate trap he fell into. And then when he found out how to make easy money, so he was this workaholic guy, and then he got into buying like a bar and a hotel and duplexes, trying to build wealth. And in a very limited short period of time, he became a meth dealer. And just going fast forward, and I'm talking a very short period of time of, you know, that love of money trap that some people fall into. He just basically, he had my uncle murdered, contract murdered, and again, became a meth dealer, and then his life started to crumble. And then it ultimately ended in a police confrontation. Mm. And, of course, my parents were divorced at that point, but everything happened in a very short window of years, like 3 years. He went from
the businessman.
Good guy, hard worker, owned business, owned like those big landscaping businesses that just boomed. Had a bunch of guys working for him. And then he got into the owning his own, you know, hotel and bar and deli and big apartments. Not huge, not like a Donald Trump situation.
But enough to be pretty comfortable.
Well, yeah. I mean, we were, I would call it at one little section, maybe that's a, you would call it high middle class. So comfortable, but then quickly
spiraled
down fast. Probably as soon as my parents got divorced, as soon as, you know, my dad kind of became a womanizer, and all those things started to unravel on him. You know, my mom, enough's enough kind of thing. And
right. Do you know what precipitated him to have his, I'm assuming it's his brother, your uncle, killed?
Yeah, they owned an apartment building together, and it was probably an insurance job. I think the benefit was a couple hundred grand for my dad, because they owned this apartment building jointly.
Yeah.
And I think my uncle, and I don't want to throw my uncle under the bus, because I was a kid at the time.
Right.
And, but I think he was in the recording conversations, and there was that element of my dad wanting him out of the picture, which was his own brother.
Yeah.
You know, so you could see where that would
That's
cause. My grandfather knew my dad had something to do with the murder, even though my dad paid a fella to do it. There's a lot of ironies. I document that in the first chapter because you don't realize your father forms you.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't realize the influence, and why that's in the first chapter of the book is because, and you know, like my co-writer said, you know, even my dad said it to me when I went along with him on a meth deal. And, you know, when I was involved in drugs and doing some very stupid things as a juvenile delinquent, that's the direction I was headed.
Mm-hmm.
And I talk about some of the occasions where my dad, that's how far he went downhill. And who's going to take their son on a meth deal, you know?
Yeah.
And was I 14 years old at the time? And just crazy things like that. And, you know, I was in the other extreme. I couldn't wait to tell my buddies how cool it was, you know, how cool my dad was.
Mm-hmm.
That took me on a drug deal, you know, that was significant, you know.
Yeah.
You know, a pound of crystal meth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, purple crystal meth, that was a, you know, a drug in the day in the 70s, and you know, it still is, but it was like that biker
right.
crowd customer drug, you know, in the mm-hmm. day, and probably truckers as well. But anyway, but I was my mindset thought that was the coolest thing, you know, mm-hmm. smoking a joint with my dad. A year before that, he caught me smoking marijuana, and he backhanded me and made me call my mom. You know, that this is how far my dad had deteriorated. Yeah, the transition.
In that time frame, wow.
Right. So those kinds of things influence you more than you think they do. Mm-hmm. You know, now I look back in that, and I know what a father is, and I know how important a father's role is. And,
right.
You know, it's the reason there's such a breakdown in our culture today of fatherlessness mm-hmm. and something I've tried to pay back to. But, yeah. And the co-author, I shared that just minutes before we went on, how he's my co-writer, came up with the Let's Go for a Ride title for the book because my dad even said it to me.
Right.
You know, and it was like, do you realize every story you wrote down and showed me somewhere along the road, the bad guy, including your father, says, let's go for a ride. And I said, yeah, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
You know, that's how that happened.
Yeah.
But that had a real profound influence on me. So here I went from a young kid, loved to hunt and fish. I had some uncles and a grandfather that I loved it. I remember my dad actually pointing out to me, Billy, you better start thinking about something else. You can't make money, you know, doing something with wildlife. And I was the Marty Stauffer. Actually, it was Mutual of Omaha back then, Flipper, yeah. Gentle Band. I mean, I was sold on being a game warden,
yeah.
you know, from Flipper, all those shows.
Yeah.
And that's how I had it, you know, you are as a kid. But then right. when I took that turn and went into the whole drug scene world and all that, and was basically following my dad's footsteps mm-hmm. unknowingly, you know, and you know, those influences were huge.
Mm.
Yeah. You know?
And when's the shift occur to that? Well, to hey, I want to be a game warden.
So before I turned into a juvenile delinquent, I actually wanted to be a game warden. From what I just told you, with all
that.
But then, still wanting that, I still trapped. Even when I was a druggie and whatever, I still hunted and fished mm-hmm. and trapped. And even though I was like dabbling in both worlds, that they don't really go together,
right?
And I was also a wrestler and a football player. So even though I was really rough around the edges, I had coaches kind of pull me in. They knew I didn't have a dad around, especially when my dad died in that police confrontation. I had some guys that they saw the need. I didn't know I had a need, but they
right.
saw the need, trying to pull me in. And I was actually waking up. Right after my dad's death, I got using drugs pretty hard, like meth mm-hmm. and stuff like that. It used to be just a weekend thing with like the harder drugs. But then I got, you know, doing all the stupid stuff that kids do. I'm young now. I'm 15 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing hard drugs now, you know, maybe not LSD and different things. I never wanted to lose control. I always wanted control, even if I'd get really wasted on Quaaludes or something like that.
Yeah.
And, but I can remember really being, I was a happy-go-lucky kid.
Mm-hmm.
It was like my personality trait even then. And but I was broken. I was like really inwardly broken. And after my dad's death, I'd like see people laugh. And I remember when I went to the papers saying the biggest drug dealer on the East Coast, you know, it was, you know, exaggerated a little bit. I mean, he wasn't that, but he was bad. Mm-hmm. And they hadn't solved the murder yet. But then when the murder happened, that was a whole nother wave of when they were able to tie it to my dad as being the actual, you know, contractor murder thing that he hired. Anyway, and that guy got convicted. And that guy was convicted through an undercover guy. There's some huge ironies in this story. You know, who would have thought that I would have become an undercover investigator and come to find out how they got the guy that murdered my uncle that my dad paid to murder his brother. They did it through an undercover guy establishing the, getting the evidence, putting it together. And so there's a lot of ironies in what I explain. But anyway, back to what changed me from that pivotal situation. I mean, I remember waking up at night, and I don't know if you want to call them panic attacks or just waking up and breaking out in a sweat. I remember, you know, I wasn't a religious kid, didn't know anything about anything. All I knew was I knew there was a God, and I knew I was a bad kid. So anyway, I had a friend invite me to Fellowship of Christian Athletes, and because I was a wrestler and a football player, I really understood where I was. You know, when you start thinking about life, now I'm 17. So I had quit drugs, everything. You know, I self-medicated with alcohol to deal with anxiety of life or all those things. Because my mom owned a bar, I had way too much access to alcohol. Yeah. I mean, I was the kind of kid that had the keys. So a 15-year-old kid, if I wanted a bottle of Jack Daniels, I got it, you know. Yeah. And I'd tell my mom some fib that I was going up there with my friends to play pool when everything was closed, and I would do whatever I wanted, you know. And and you get a lot of friends when your mom owns a bar.
Yeah, I bet you do.
So I had 20-year-old friends. I was 15, 16 years old, and I had older friends because they knew I could have access to different things. And anyway,
yeah.
So fast forward back to where I was. I went out of order there a little bit, but so I made a commitment to the Lord at 17 that, you know, my life's a mess. I admit it. Change. And so I totally took a different direction. So now I don't, well, I'd quit drugs when I was 15, just me saying, that's it. Begging God to stop me from waking up and breaking out in a sweat. I don't know if I was just experiencing anxiety or maybe it was the drugs or whatever it was, but I remember saying, hey,
did you blame law enforcement for your dad's death?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my word. Right after the police confrontation and when my dad, he actually committed suicide, they were shooting tear gas in the house and caught it on fire with the devices, you know, they used back then. And this was in 1979, September 17th when it happened. And the place caught on fire and they just had to let it burn. Well, while it was burning, I guess he, you know, shot himself in the head. My sister and I were there watching and so anyway, I was bitter. I was actually bitter enough to where, you know, when you're a kid, 15, you're planning in your mind like revenge. I remember that. I can remember, oh, I'm going to hold those guys responsible who did this, you know. And then you had the whole guilt, you know, 15-year-old, what could I have done? I was there. Could I have got, I was going to meet my dad was on the run for a while and he came back in town. My sister and I were invited to his girlfriend's house to where we were going to have supper with him. And we get there and the whole place is, you know, it's rocking and rolling. Well, it wasn't burning real bad yet, but it started to while we were there. And, you know, and that's when he ended up, you know, committing suicide in the house. But I was bitter. I was bitter towards law enforcement. But then, of course, I'm back and forth here a little bit. But when I was 17 and made that commitment, you could just tell some of those big weights that I had, those big chips on my shoulders about what occurred, you know, 2 years earlier, they were faded, you know, and I totally different direction. So I didn't use drugs or anything. I still had that crowd that knew me and that were friends with me, but they all know, Livesey's. Back then they said straight. Now it means something different. but I was straight then too.
Yeah, I was going to say it's you. They were right on both accounts.
Yeah, right. So anyway, so proceeding on, went back to my passion, you know, to be a game warden. Of course, I was quite a little poacher then, too. I told you I was in that little bit of a drug world. And then, you know, you have that clique of friends and then you go out and kill something or whatever. And so after I became a Christian, I'm like, yeah, all this is wrong. And I'm not participating in that kind of activity, you know. And, of course, I like to say, you know, I'm 50. Going to be 59. The Lord's still working on me kind of thing, you know. So, well, what that said, there was a lot of rough edges that had to come off Bill Livesey before he would be game warden someday, you know, at eight, from 17 on. There's a lot of rough edges that had to come off. So anyway, I went to Unity College, you know, I was born and raised in Pennsylvania, and had a guy tell me, you know what, there's this college up in, this is before colleges had a lot of conservation law programs.
Right, yep.
There's this college up there to Unity, you know, that has all these programs about wildlife and different things. And he goes, man, you would fit right into that because he knew my passion. There's people like this fella here that like saw my passion and kind of threw out some direction. Right. You know, looking back, everything was falling into place. So I ended up going to Unity College, going to get married soon to my high school sweetheart. That was the other thing that happened when I was 17. I, you know, I found a nice girl.
And I understand that my friends are shocked at that too.
So anyway, started dating her back when I was a junior in high school. And anyway, we were going to get married, and you know, I went to Unity College, and I was riding with John Ford, and these things just happened, and here I am, just a college kid riding with John Ford, and. Of course, he wasn't big on following all the policies in place. You know? So we're out, you know, he catching night hunters. And once you get addicted to that, that adrenaline of here I am in college, I mean, I knew exactly what I needed to do. And I still had poacher buddies back home. And, hey, you're not going to have any friends. And why would you want to be a game warden? Nobody's going to like you. And I'm like, you know what? You know, I found my passion. And I talk about that in the book as well. That and then back to what we said earlier, you don't realize the gift and the skill set that inadvertently, because of some of the things I saw and observed, you know, having all these mentors in my mom's hotel bar that would take me hunting or whatever. They were pretty rough around the edges. Exactly. Some of them were,
they taught you all kinds of ways to do it wrong.
Right. And then some of them did it right. I don't want to take that away from some. There were some that were doing it right, but there was a lot of them that were doing it wrong, and they were good guys to me, and they taught me things and the wrong things, but they didn't know they were also helping me learn skills.
An education for the future that you could apply.
I didn't get hired on as a game warden right away. There was a lot of competition, you know, 1,700, 2,600 applicants for five jobs.
I remember that similar time frames, and it was
five
tough.
Jobs, 10 jobs. When I got refused in Maine the first two times, I was devastated because in the polygraph, I told them everything. And I had a lot to tell, and I said every little detail of every deviant act I've ever done, and of course, some questions that are on that polygraph are very pointed.
Yes, they are. And there's a lot of them.
Oh, yeah. A lot of them.
They must have had to come back for a separate day on you, huh?
I was 5.5 hours on my first polygraph, the Maine Warden Service. And I remember getting there early, and my appointment was 9:30 at the crime lab in Augusta. And they're like, hey, well, you're here early. We might as well get set up, because they had already background me and knew a lot of details already. And I didn't eat breakfast. They told me not to eat breakfast, and then of course I was hooked up so long and interviewed so
there,
long
there goes through lunch
we went through lunch, and it's 2:30 in the afternoon before I was cut loose. And I just remember coming out of there feeling less than human.
Probably more so than most of us, because I think all of us come out of there feeling less than human. But I wasn't starved. I did have the old method where they pumped it up so tight they turned my arm blue.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, and he asked me if I was agitated, and I was like, yes, I'm agitated. And he's like, why? My arm's blue and I can't feel it.
So, the polygraph
very truthful. And that's all they want to know, if you're truthful. So, I mean, as long as you were saying the stuff, that's the bottom
actually,
line.
Actually, that wasn't quite... because I was truthful, and so I asked them. I didn't get invited to the final interview. That was the second time I tested, and I'm like, I got a letter saying, you know, you were congratulations for passing the the polygraph examination, but you are not being chosen to go to the final interview. And I was like, devastated, right?
Yeah.
You get that letter and you're like, you got to be kidding me. And I'm like, well, I can't do anything about my past. It's right there no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember communicating with Augusta and saying, hey, just curious. I called down to Augusta and I was like, I was working at the state prison at the time for the state of Maine. And hoping to not be a corrections officer, nothing against corrections, but I was an outside person.
Yeah, not an inside person. Yeah,
yeah. That's, and ended up staying there 3.5 years because I didn't get hired that time. But I asked him, is it worth me even applying again?
Right.
Because I can't change my past.
Right.
I'm who I am. I made some bad decisions, a lot of them, as a kid. I mean, I was really young, though. And that's actually probably what helped. Most kids don't even try drugs till they're,
right,
you know, yeah, let alone being involved.
I mean, you quit at 15. Most right kids don't start till they're 16, I would think.
Oh, that's the, yeah. Yeah. And, so the foolish decisions I made, fortunately, I made them as a real young person. I think that helped. But then they saw the pattern moving forward.
Right.
And they told me, no, you should apply again. And I said, well, I appreciate that. And so sure enough, you know, when Maine did it like every other year back then, because the process took a year.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I remember.
Yeah. So in 1990, I actually applied in New Hampshire.
Yeah.
And I can remember I scored in the top. I was in the top two guys. Went to that final interview for New Hampshire. Now, this is before the polygraph, but they ask you some questions. It was the major, and I think it was the major and the colonel. And I could see the expressions on their face when I told them. They asked me right up, did you ever do this or ever do that? Kind of, you know, some of the same similar questions they're going to ask you in a polygraph, but specifically to narcotics or something like that. And I said, unfortunately, sir, yes. And I watched their faces. And they had already said, And so when I didn't make it in Maine, I went down to New Hampshire and and I was axed. I was there. I had the opportunity to be right at the top, and I could see the excitement on their faces. They were encouraged that this looks like a pretty good candidate. And then when I was honest with them about you know my past, I saw their it was all on their faces that I was I was done.
Right.
But then I met that same major, I think it was Mott.
Yeah, Henry Mott.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I met him later, and he's like, I knew we should have taken a chance on you, you know. So he made me feel a lot better because this was years later. I joined in on it was some kind of decoy situation where we were showing stuff. It was an interagency type of thing, and he was like, "I knew it. We should have taken a chance with you." Yeah. So that made me feel a lot better.
That's good. No, I would agree. So
yeah,
but you eventually get hired with Maine.
Yeah. So they took a chance on me, and the third time, and I got hired on, and I made a promise at the final interview that. That I was going to try to be the best game warden I can be for the state of Maine, and I was passionate about it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it was that last final interview. There's still like 25 guys in the running for the 10 positions, so it's not like you're there.
Right. Now you got
to
be the choice.
You have to sell yourself, and they came right out and said, "We know you. We know."
Well, you've had a history. This is your third time.
Yeah,
they know you're not going to go away, and good for you not to go away.
Yeah. So know? I was passionate about it. I remember thinking to my wife, discussing it with her, like, "Hey, this might, as much as I felt like it was my calling to be a game warden, and as passionate as I was to pursue it, this might never happen. I just got to suck it up and deal with it." So when I got the opportunity, I wasn't going to mess around. I was going to I'm going to try to be the best game warden I can be in the state of Maine. And they took a chance. And right out of the gate, I was pounding pretty hard. You know?
Yeah, I bet.
They put me in a mill town, the first area. And, of course, my background helped me with, you know, all the druggies. I felt bad for them. They didn't have a chance.
Right.
I could smell everything a mile away, you know, and made some hard feelings there with checking somebody deer hunting, and they just got done smoking a joint, man. They were bumming that The new young game warden knew all that stuff. So yeah, had some very productive years as a uniform guy, and caused a little hard feelings. There were some issues there. You know, OUI enforcement was new for game wardens,
right?
All the people I caught night hunting as a uniform guy, and all those like what you would consider, you know, regular poaching catches. Mm-hmm. As upsetting as they would be for getting caught, they still knew that's what a game warden did. But when we were asked to do OUI enforcement, man, did that cause some hard feelings.
Yep.
You know, it was new. Game wardens didn't go out in a boat and catch drunks in a boat. And snowmobilers, we always went snowmobiling with a 30-pack. And now this young game wardens, I grew up in a bar. I could pick drunks out all day long.
Oh, I bet you could.
And they did hate that. And it was a mill town, and people played hard. And, mill towns are shift work and that kind of thing. And guys had the toys to go play hard.
Mm-hmm. That paid well and it was a hard job.
Yeah, it was a Lincoln District. Yeah, it was a tough job. Yeah. They got paid well for them, and then they play hard. And now this young game warden comes along.
Yeah, like young game wardens do, and
I love the job. That was the problem. You know, I love my wife, but it was hard to get me home to because you get addicted to the chase,
and yes,
of course, and you get addicted to catching night hunters, and it's the same dopamine that the bad guys have for going out and killing the deer, or
100%, 100%. Yeah.
So that's what happened. I was very, very passionate.
Yeah. So how'd your wife adjust to the life of the game warden?
She loved it, but it was hard.
Yeah.
It was we had four kids, and as the years went, we had one born while I was in the police academy, so that would have been my second one. And then we had two more children after that, so she had her hands full. So when I did have a break from work, if it wasn't the fall when I was right out straight working like a lunatic, and of course I got hired back in the day when...
You worked 14 hours a day, or you didn't work an hour?
Well, it even was worse, but we were hired. In fact, I remember Colonel Cummings was his name, a very old school colonel, but even he said, you work over 8 hours, you're out, because it was that day and age when there were lawsuits.
The Garcia was coming in.
Yeah, the state of Maine, they weren't paying anything over 8. Mm-hmm. And if you worked over 8 and got caught, you were out. Mm-hmm. That's how strict, because of all the different things that were going on. And I was like, and old timers hated it because they didn't want to look like a slacker.
Right.
I was taught by the old timers, John Fords and different guys. I rode with Tim Peabody and Roland Tilton, different game wardens I rode with. They were old school mindset. You work until the job's done, and in the fall, you know how that is.
Oh, yeah.
And so that very first year, we were just felt like we were doing everything wrong because we were always out working. And I partnered up with Dave Georgia, another game warden, and we just put the hammer down because we feed off each other as far as we both love to catch night hunters, and we had a lot of success because of that. But we were working like fools, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's hard on family too.
Yes, it is.
Yeah,
for sure.
Going right around the clock being a zombie, you know.
Yeah. Did it get better when you went undercover?
That was probably worse.
Worse.
Well, I was a part-time undercover guy for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But then when I was promoted to a game warden investigator and dove into the whole undercover world, I was recruited. Terry Hunter was an investigator, and he basically came up to me and said, we think you have a gift set that would be helpful to us.
Right.
Would you be willing to work in this capacity?
Mm-hmm.
And I go into the book too a little bit, because not everybody can do that kind of work.
You know? No.
I don't think I'm anybody special, but for whatever reason, that kind of came easy to me.
Mm-hmm. I think being likable is a big part of it too.
Yeah, a lot of people don't understand undercover work isn't that technical.
Mm-hmm.
It's being liked and being trusted.
Mm-hmm.
It's only two things.
Yeah.
And I said,
and you got to be liked before you're trusted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's not always if it's a buy and selling thing. If I'm buying deer off a bad guy or whatever, that mm-hmm. kind of commercial thing. It's not liking you isn't as important.
Right.
And it can work against you. This guy's been killing whatever and selling it to everybody else. If he mm-hmm. likes you too much, he won't sell it to you. You know what I mean? So that's worked against me in a few cases over the years.
Yeah.
And, you know, I did that 20 years. But when I was a when I got promoted in 2007 to be a full-time investigator, I could really focus. And the reason I jumped on it, I had some struggles doing it. I'm like, mm-hmm. you know, that's the dark side I came out of. Do I want to befriend people of that crowd, mm-hmm. pretend to be like I was just right. to catch them? There's a lot of psychology in doing undercover work.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine.
I struggled more than some people. That some people thought it was really easy to me, and it was easy as far as being able to make the contact and get in with that group of bad guys that, you know, it's a group of felons that needed to be caught, and they were just bad, bad poachers. But they were also doing everything else. A lot of the cases I worked, they'd be drug dealing, doing a little bit of a home invasion and take somebody's drugs so they could sell them, and marijuana ripper offers and just thieves. The gamut just goes, the range is just bizarre, mm-hmm. Because most poachers just don't poach. They're usually doing everything.
Right.
So, yeah, but that's hard on your psyche. Mm-hmm. So you think, you're working really bad people, but I don't care if you're undercover working bikers, mm-hmm. you're undercover working the mob. If you hear the testimonies of some of them undercover guys, they struggle. That Stockholm syndrome is real. Mm-hmm. So you're basically befriending people. And then you feel like a Judas when it's all over, because the betrayal is you're not Bill the friend. You're right. Bill the undercover game warden.
Yeah.
And you just observed all those crimes they committed. And not only did you observe them, you documented it, and now they're going to be held accountable. So the struggle is they pull you into their home. There's a huge trust, like mm-hmm. you mentioned.
Yep, sit around the dinner table.
The trust is established. They trust you with their kids. You know, there's this huge trust, and now there's this huge betrayal.
Right.
I struggled with that whole 20 years. Mm-hmm. So people would ask me, you must have loved catching those guys. Well, I did. I loved that a guy that needed to be caught finally got caught, because some of the reasons we worked guys was they knew all our tricks. They were guys that right. were very careful, and uniform situations weren't able to apprehend them.
Right.
So if they were bad enough and we made this big decision to work a particular group and then we committed to working them, we got them, and we got them really good, because mm-hmm. undercover cases, you're not only there when they're killing everything and doing everything, but you hear all the conversation, all the planning, all the past things, all the future things.
Right.
You're part of the group. Mm-hmm. So the evidence mountain is huge.
Right.
And so as far as liking undercover work, when people would ask me, mm-hmm. is it reasonable or understandable that I felt like I could do it well? I was very successful at it, but I didn't necessarily like it.
Gotcha.
Even when I was going into a new case, my mindset was like, every time I started a new case, and I try to run with three every fall, because that's about all you can psychologically handle. You know, especially if I'm sleeping with a group of people a week at a time.
Yeah.
And there's only, you know, the main killing time of the year is August maybe to December. You know, you got a window. And if you're making multiple contacts in a fall,
right.
You can only have so many cases.
Absolutely.
It's very draining, and you do need a little decompressed time between a case, just so your wife still loves you and your kids recognize who you are. And those kinds of things are very stressful, too. You know, not being able to go to a kid's ball game if it was out of my area, just on the idea that there might be a connection also watching the ball game.
Yeah.
Or me having to watch a ball game of my kid from a distance. It was those kinds of sacrifices were brutal on the family.
I think I can see where that would be.
Yeah, but I did enjoy catching a really bad guy. But I didn't necessarily like, even though that's the way it's done, that betrayal part.
Yeah.
And that befriending and betrayal, because that's what it comes down to. But it was the tool. It's a great tool to catch really bad people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah, when it works. Yeah.
Where uniforms can't do that.
Well, uniforms do a lot of great work.
Right.
But
I shouldn't say they can't do it. It's usually on luck if they do it.
Right.
So,
or it's connecting dots. It's really, really good investigative work. If you're a uniform or even overt investigations, it's time-consuming collecting the dots. Look how easy it is when you're sitting in the vehicle when three guys night hunt a moose.
Mm-hmm.
There is no collecting evidence and dots. You're right there when it happened.
Right. You got them.
And not only for that moose, the next two that they kill, and then that until you shut the case down.
Right.
And, so it's not only the poor uniform guy, because I was one, I get it. It's mm-hmm. all this work connecting dots to make a case. Unless, you know, it's a night hunter that happens right in front of you, and then you get them that one time.
Right.
But you don't get them next week and the week after, you know.
100%, yeah.
You know how that is. So undercover cases were a huge tool for Maine Warden Service, and, you know, and for other states.
For sure.
To get really bad guys, yeah.
Yeah, 100%. I was told a story, and I'm not even sure if it's in the book, because I hate to say it, I haven't read your book yet. So.
Well, good. I hope I didn't blow it saying too much.
No, yeah, but we're going to get to the ending eventually, I hope. I mean, oh, man. That's why I say there's going to be an audio book in the future, Bill, because so busy. I listen to books all the time when I'm doing other things, but yeah. Sitting down and reading a book is a challenge for me.
Yeah. That's how I read my first few. Even though I wrote a book, I'm not a big reader,
yeah.
So I feel like I'm cheating when I do it audibly, but that's the way I get it done.
You'll do a great job narrating it, as you should, so because that passion carries through. But the time you were the guy that caught you, that told him you pulled over the truck and said he was the game warden.
Yeah, that's a true story. That was Operation Beals Island, and... he was not the primary target, but he was a younger guy in his 20s that, you know, had been quite a night hunter. And mm-hmm. and we had actually just killed a deer, and we're driving along in the truck. And all of a sudden, you know, he blasts me with a few vulgar words and says, "Pull the F over. You're under arrest. I'm an effing undercover game warden." And I don't know how my face looked, but it must have been... It did catch me off guard, so it was a real response to his
right.
obnoxious and realistic comment, and I just stopped the truck and looked over at him. He's like, "Gotcha!"
And that was a real response.
Yeah, oh, yeah. He goes, "You should have seen your face," you know. And he went on and on and on. Of course, you know, I know how the end of the case is going to go.
Yeah.
So the joke's on him, unfortunately. But
man,
I actually heard that fellow turned his life around, which. He was pretty hard the other way, so
yeah.
That was encouraging to hear that.
That's good.
Yeah, so that's somebody that's hopefully he's not into the poaching, but hopefully he's not into the drugs and mm-hmm. the heavy drinking and all the other issues he had. And so, yeah, it's yeah, nice to see that sometimes yeah. they change. I'm convinced it wasn't because of being caught, but it's still nice to see people do change.
Right. Did you have a favorite case that you actually kind of enjoyed working?
I enjoyed all of them to a degree.
Mm-hmm.
Like I would, one of the things I would do working a case is so it wouldn't look fake is I would really try to, and some people I worked were very, very vile, very hard to like,
mm-hmm.
but I would find something psychologically. I would try to find something that I liked about them and I'd really hone in. So it wouldn't be fake. Does that make sense?
Well, give me an example.
Well, okay, there was a guy that was really, really rough and really, really hard to be around. Just the way he talked, the way he acted, his arrogance.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a wrestler.
Ah, you had a connection.
So we had that thing we could talk about. Mm-hmm. And we had that, and then I think he even coached a little.
Okay.
And this guy was... This guy was hard.
Mm-hmm.
This was the guy, I brought it up in one of the classes I taught today, that I was on a bear. He was a guide, and he was on a bear hunt with him. And poor Bubba that was holding the lead of the dog slipped out of his hand, after they wanted me to shoot the bear out of the tree. It was a hound hunt. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the guys' prime hounds and plot. And he, the reason you hold the dogs back is so when the bear's dying, he doesn't grab onto the skull one of them dogs and kill your best dog. Right. Yeah. So anyway, that bear happened to just fall into a big blowdown, kind of a hard place to get to. And that dog, when he came loose and went, dove right in on top of that bear. Well, the guy, very unstable guy, he was a guy who was just saying that we had that common thing with the, and so he just out of his mind and quick, he had a 454 mag and he just quick reaches over and freaking pops that bear a couple times in the head and he is screaming. Well, now poor Bubba, this 35-year-old, just loves this mean older guy that he's his mentor, his poaching mentor. And he is on his hands and knees and bawling. And this guy is out of his mind. And I literally thought I was going to witness a homicide. Mm. And like, I had only been in on this and hunts, dog hunts. They call it a race. When it's on, it's on. It's very intense. You know, you got dogs barking. You got all kinds of chaos. Yeah. And so picture this 35, 36-year-old man on his hands and knees just bawling. Poor Bubba, the big wad of chew in his mouth, letting the hoots out of him, begging for forgiveness. And here you got this guy that's lost his mind, and he's got this 454 mag that he just got done finishing off the bear, and he's got the hammer back and he's got it pointed right at the head of his buddy. And I'm like, okay, am I gonna witness a homicide here?
Yeah.
Anyway, that's how vile. I was just trying to give you a flavor of how vile this, he's just a very vile guy. But there was that wrestling thing we had where I could focus on that. So everything looked real.
Right.
You know, there's one thing as an undercover guy, you don't want it to be fake.
Right.
The relationship has to feel real. Mm-hmm. And that was one of my techniques I used, especially with, well, with any target I worked, I would, and it was hard sometimes to find something I liked. But then other guys were the complete opposite. Other guys felt like a friend for real.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were just easy to be around.
Yeah.
And I had those guys too.
Yeah.
And there were guys, so when I talked about Stockholm Syndrome and and just feeling bad for the bad guy that needed to be caught, when I worked those kind of guys, the end of the case was just as hard on me as it was on them as far as, you know, I felt horrible that they were being caught even though they needed to be caught because I knew that betrayal was going to...
The kind of people you had Thanksgiving dinner during hunting season at their house.
I've had several Thanksgiving meals with bad guys, and some really liked me. And
yeah,
some
they treated you like family if you were there for Thanksgiving. So
exactly. Yeah. I was family, and they were easy to like. There's guys that were – they would keep me in stitches, and I wasn't faking laughing.
Yeah.
You know, funny guys I worked, but they were bad, and they needed to be caught, and they were outlaws, and – there are outlaws that are fun to be around, but they need to be held accountable, you know, and those cases were really hard on me too, psychologically, you know, working those.
Yeah. Any really funny incidents that happened?
Too many? There's that. There's the guy screaming at me that, but I don't know how many cases, I actually talked about this in one of the classes today, where guys have been caught night hunting. And then, so I'm with them. So they've learned some things and evidence gathering and different things. So whether it's a night hunted moose, and I just remember one guy just working so hard because he night hunted this moose and there was a skiff of snow. I actually did the same thing when he shot a deer at night when I was with him there and worked so hard to get those shells retrieved. Worked so hard. And then he'd give me that smirk, like, see, this is why I'm never going to get caught again. And he'd hold the shell in front of my face, like, he finally found it, and it was a victory. And then he'd hand it to me, you know? and I'd smile, and I'd say, good job, and put it in my pocket. You know? And it was just, I can't even count. There's that exact same scenario where they just thought they were above, and I use the other scenario, the one guy saying, you know, there's been all kinds of funny things that have happened. One scenario, and I mentioned that one too, you know, we're tracking this illegal bear and he's in front of me and so proud. And I would play into people's egos, you know, man, I can't believe you saw that deer. That's just one of the other techniques I'd use. And they had shot a bear and he was going to get another guy to tag it, but we didn't find it yet. And we're tracking it. We come up to this road and we're way up in the North Main woods off the Reality Road there. And he's like looking around. He's pretty puffed up. He was an illegal guide and doing everything wrong. And I had paid him for a bear hunt. And he looks back at me and he's whispering. He goes, "That's why I've never been caught." He goes, "I'm always one step ahead of the game warden," you know. And he's being real sneaky, going through the bushes. And I can remember when we started walking, continue tracking, I just remember looking down. He's like, "Yeah, he's about one step ahead of the game warden." You know, just those little things that don't mean much to anybody else.
Anybody else, but they make you chuckle because it's a whole different. Right, so. Right.
Piles of those kinds of things.
Yeah. You know? In the end, were you in on when the search warrants happened and things like that?
Oh, yeah, we would.
So. They would see Bill, their friend, to Bill, the game warden.
Yes. And while we avoided, we changed things. When we started doing takedowns, we didn't think it was productive if they actually saw you. Sometimes,
right.
Sometimes our operative, if there was a struggle with acknowledging something took place. But we moved away from that. I was usually at a command post. Mm-hmm. And if we would have interviewers. And at that point, it really didn't matter if things were corroborated that way. Right. If like they confessed, I shot four deer at night with Bill or whatever. But I'd have it all laid out.
Yeah.
So when we chose interviewers to interview one of the bad guys, I'd be at a command post, and they might call me, and he might hear my voice and say, "Hey, look, Bill is one of us. He's a game warden." Like kind of the gig's up.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time, they'd either say, "Well, I ain't saying nothing, fly," or other times they'd say, "You know, well, I'm really caught," you know.
Right.
But either way, it really didn't matter because usually we had such a mound of evidence.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, they knew it was me, and they knew sometimes I would communicate, you know, on such and such a date, that's when he killed this or that or the other thing, whatever the crimes were, you know, stole the Jeep, did this, did that, sold the Jeep, you know, all those things, you know, whatever the details were of whatever the crime was.
Yeah. Oh, very interesting. So, and you were like 20 years doing the undercover?
Yeah, too long. I would say definitely too long. The problem with undercover work is you get really skilled at between 5 and 10 years at actually doing it. And then, like in the situation with me, I was trying to bow out after around 10 years, trying to train newer guys to just do it. But not everybody's comfortable doing it. Not everybody's successful at doing it.
Right.
So you're going through people that might have that ability. And it just seems like every time when I wasn't doing a case and I knew there were bad guys out there that needed to be caught that way, I was frustrated. And then when I was doing a case, I'm like, you know, I was supposed to get out of this, and here I am doing another one and another one. And so I was caught in that place, that catch 22, that wanting to get out of it, but also wanting people caught that needed to be caught. And then, you know, I wouldn't want a new guy going into a situation if the group was talking about killing the game warden and they were a really vile group. Well, you don't want to put a guy that hasn't done many those kinds of cases. So I'd be like, "All right, I'll do that one because we don't want to put."
Because that would weigh on your conscience.
Yeah,
if
because I was doing it long enough where I had say. You know, we'd have these roundtable discussions of, you know, who's going to work this case. We'd look at the cases that would be submitted. There was quite a process. We just didn't. We weren't on fishing trips working undercover cases. Mm-hmm. They were piles of information that came in. A game warden would usually submit it. This is what we think's going on in my area, and this is all the players. These are the targets. These guys, this group is all felons. This group is maybe one or two felons in it. We know they're hunting. We know they're doing this, but they know how to avoid regular standard law enforcement, or they've been doing a good job at avoiding it. And so anyway, it would be a big discussion, and then we try to look at the profiles, do backgrounds, who would be the best fit to work that kind of person, different personalities. Like, you know, the personalities are a big thing for working cases. You know, if you've got that, you know, real hard control freak kind of person, very, you got to be looking at the personality of even your operative, of
something that's going to fit.
Yeah. You're looking for a good fit.
Yeah.
And then what would happen, and that's why I dragged on, because it, the case would be like maybe a little too dangerous, and I'd say, why don't I do this one? And give one maybe that's not as a lower risk situation.
And it's probably hard to move another operative into that position.
Yeah.
Because, you know you can go in and handle it. And
right.
to make that transition for somebody else is tough. Because if something goes wrong,
yeah.
I can't even imagine.
Well, that's the thing. So if you're not working a case as the operative, that's how we did it back then, is you might be the case manager. Well, the case manager's job is to make sure the guy's safe somewhat. Mm-hmm. We changed a lot of policies regarding risk and safety issues since like some events that took place. But
Your former Colonel Joel Wilkinson actually shared some of his experiences as an undercover, and some of them not so pleasant.
Joel was very good at it. One thing Joel shared, Colonel Wilkinson shared with me one time, is that's the psychological stress, like getting the massive migraine.
Right.
Like you don't even realize you're under the stress. I can remember coming from a case where they're putting a knife to my throat and really calling me out of being a possible game warden.
Right.
And thinking I handled it, thinking I got through it. And then I remember on the ride, I would always ride a certain direction before I turn around and ride to where I really live, you know, and try to get home and with a covert vehicle, or try to get to a situation or a safe spot or whatever. And I remember riding back from that one case where I was really called out, and I got way past all my go-to lines on trying to relieve the old, are you a effing game warden kind of thing, undercover drug agent or whatever you're getting accused of. That one got real. That's in the book about it got to the point where I was going to knock the guy out if he came at me with a knife one more time, because it was all over it was way past the fun stage. You know, when you're in a camp out in the middle of the woods and there's no backup, you don't have a gun on you, and I had to make a decision. Anyway, when I left that contact or those series of days, I felt that enormous stress. I actually got emotional, and I'm one of those fools that holds everything in and never cries. My wife only ever seen me cry like once or twice, I think, maybe just once. But so I remember getting emotional. That's how draining that case was, and like, I'm thinking, what the heck am I doing this still?
Yeah.
I mean, this is Maine's one big small town. It's only a matter of time before you're really, you know, people are related to people in different parts of the state. I mean, I did do things in other states helping out. There was a nexus to Maine.
Right.
But really, I mean, that's, I was 20 years is way beyond the years I should have been in it. Even though the problem is you gain so much experience in doing it.
Right.
So there you are. You're stuck, you know.
Right. And now you're retired.
Yeah,
and you write a book.
Retired. Yeah.
About your experiences.
I was kind of pressured into writing a book. I mean,
I think it's good.
Yeah. There's a little taboo with an undercover guy writing a book.
100%.
So I struggled with that. I wasn't going to write one. And then the co-writer with me, Darren Worcester, who did an awesome job. Like, I wrote the chapters. I read the chapters I wrote. I'm breaking out in a sweat because he had that ability to put
the reader there.
The reader's in the situation. And I wrote it. I even know what's going to happen, and I'm breaking out in a sweat. So Darren Worcester just did an outstanding job at being able to do that. All I had to do was tell him the stories and write them down, and he made that reader. Well, you know how law enforcement officers are. We have everything in chronological order. So this event, this started here and ended here, and he had that ability to – he kind of would go back and forth in the situation.
Right.
And he just really did a good job. That's what makes it a good read, actually.
Yeah.
Because the reader through the whole book is in it. The reader is in the case, you know. And that's what makes it a good read.
Yeah. That's great. And thanks for sharing that so everybody can get Let's Go for a Ride. You know, take a ride with Bill Livesey. And for sure, you know, that's good. I think everybody should take a read, especially if a sportsman, a game warden. I think this is going to be a special ride for everybody that takes it, especially if that co-writer puts you there, because that's so much.
Yeah.
So, not that I'm going to wait for the audiobook either. So, yeah. But that's generally how I read now. I hate to say it. So, I'm looking forward to you reading your book, and we'll get that out there. But thanks, Bill, for sitting down with me and talking about your book, talking about your experiences, talking about your life, because that's opening up and sharing with people. You know, you're just not making a difference probably for game wardens. Maybe you're making a difference for somebody in their lives too.
Yeah.
I think it's a pretty special thing you're doing.
Well, thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
And enjoy retirement.
Yeah.
So you deserve it.
I am enjoying it.
Thanks for joining Warden's Watch Podcast.
Please join me, Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and other game wardens on our adventures, protecting wildlife, saving lives, and having fun, all while serving the public and the natural resources of our planet. Listen to the tales and experiences of those who work in the outdoors while being entertained with stories about encounters with poachers, wildlife investigation, murder investigation, near-death experiences, search and rescue missions, wildlife interactions from game wardens around the country and around the world. When I retired, I realized I couldn't let go of that legacy, but rather wanted to share the passion, the commitment, and the stories of those men and women that call themselves game wardens. This is Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and this is Warden's Watch.